The session today is on Old Testament and Liberation, and my name is Bernie Meyer. I'm Director of Lutheran Social Services in Tacoma, Washington. So a lot of my work is in applying and living out with people in the community, justice-type work. So I'd like to invite you today to participate with this session as a sharing session based on reflecting on the Bible and how it influenced the lives of the people at the time the episodes and so forth were being described, and as it affects us today. I'm using the methodology that the ELCA is developing for social ministry, congregational social ministry. It started back in, 10 years ago in the ALC and the LCA, and when the merger took place in 88, the ELCA continued a process of developing social ministry. And I am working with the Synod in the southwestern section of Washington to apply this process. So I'm just focusing on the biblical approach to this. It has liturgical, educational, and theological parts too, and they all overlap, of course, but this is Bible study, so I'm doing it from a Bible study point of view. And it fits me in a lot of ways. I've been involved with social ministry all my adult life, and of course I learned that just by my baptism and confirmation, we're born into social ministry. But I've tried to live it out in both professionally and personally, and so it fits me. I'm an activist. I'm not in an academic setting. I'm not in a study setting. I get bits and bites of inspiration from different sources and try to live it out. When you're involved in human services, you don't have a lot of time to reflect. On the other hand, I find it essential to reflect and pray daily. The only way to continue in social ministry is by praying. So today I'd like to begin a process, and these words on the board here are, in essence, what I'd like to draw out of the biblical process and in our own. We are, we act, and we reflect. What we're going to see biblically is that the people of Israel were slaves, they acted to get their freedom, and they reflected on the meaning of that and ascribed to God the key role in liberating themselves. So we want to see what that means in the biblical context and in our own lives, how that plays out. So maybe we could begin by just closing our eyes and reflecting a little bit about God's presence with us, within us, and among us as a people. To recall that we believe in God acting, and we believe in God's very presence in our beings. And then maybe some of us can recall times in our lives which were growth-filled, in which we were freed from material or spiritual oppression. and how we came to a deeper realization that God brought it about despite us, maybe, or with our cooperation and heartfelt desire. I'd like to begin where we left off the liturgy last night. It was, I thought, a very meaningful liturgy. It just happens that it interfaces pretty nicely with our Bible study this morning. We dealt with the theme of South African experience in terms of the music. Scott talked about the feeding of the multitude with the loaves and fishes and how that nourished both body and soul. And we concluded with a dance. Some of you might have stayed for the dance that went beyond the liturgy. It was quite a dance. I enjoyed it. But let's start with Miriam's dance today. In Exodus. Exodus is a key experience for the Israel people because around that experience of freedom from slavery to freedom in the promised land, their whole relationship with God was formed, and as a people they were formed. Had roots back with Abraham, of course, but as an Israel people, they were formed by that Exodus experience, and that Christ becomes a counterpart of that experience in the New Testament, which we'll talk about tomorrow and later. So we'd like to focus on chapter 15, but before that, I'd maybe just recall a little bit what happened. The people were settled nicely in Egypt. Fled the famine in Joseph's time and got a home in Egypt. But as time went along, they became slaves. Their numbers grew, and the people there decided to oppress them kind of gradually. But it got to such a point that at the end of chapter 2, the people cried out. Chapter 2, verse 23 to 25. After a long time, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. God responded after God had acted initially in forming a people. And the next chapters go through the call of Moses. And Moses, somewhat reluctant choice to become a leader with his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam in freeing the people in a So it's a narration of God's acts with people's acts, people's choices to free the people of Israel. And chapter 15 is a celebration poem by Moses and then by Miriam of that freedom. So appreciate it if somebody would read chapter 15, verses 1 to 23. Pardon me, verses 1 to 21.
Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his hosts he has cast into the sea, and his picked officers are sunk in the Red Sea. The floods cover them, they went down into the depth like a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of thy majesty, thou overthrowest thy adversaries. Thou sendest forth thy fury, it consumes them like stubble. At the blast of thy nostrils, the waters piled up, the floods stood up in a heap, the deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil, my desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, the sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, terrible in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Thou didst stretch out thy right hand, the earth swallowed them. Thou hast led in thy steadfast love the people whom thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them by thy strength to thy holy abode. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized on the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling seizes them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of thy arm. They are as still as a stone till thy people, O Lord, pass by. Till the people pass by whom thou hast purchased. Thou wilt bring them in and plant them on thy own mountain, the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thy abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which thou hast established. The Lord will reign forever and ever. For when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought back the water of the sea upon them, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. Then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her timbrels and dancing. And Miriam sang to them, Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea.
Thank you, Ted. We have here quite an expression of exultation, thanksgiving, praise of God. But maybe we could look at what happened here. The people of Israel fled, and they got through the sea just in time before the sea went back and, in this case, wiped out the Egyptian army. So they were thinking, thank God we're safe. But there are indications in there that this didn't happen quite this way. This chapter is a reflection of the people of Israel later in time. And an indication of this is verses 13 to 16. Is your steadfast love, in your steadfast love, you led the people from whom you redeemed. You guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The peoples heard, they trembled. Pang seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. Trembling seized the leaders of Moab. And all the inhabitants of Canaan melted away. Terror and dread fell upon them. By the might of your arm, they became still as a stone, until your people, O Lord, passed by, until the people whom you acquired passed by. This was obviously written after the people were in the promised land. And thinking of the fact that they got through Edom and Moab and Philistia. So it's a celebration long after the crossing of the Red Sea. But it's portrayed in, as a sense of just happening after the Red Sea. You know, it appears that this came out of Moses' mouth and Miriam's mouth right away. So we can reflect on this as it happened to them and then compare it maybe to some of our own experiences. What I see happening is they must have caught their breath after crossing the Red Sea and said, you know, huffing and puffing, thank God we're free. And probably Miriam did dance, you know, of sorts, and people did celebrate. But how much they appreciated what happened at that moment, as opposed to their appreciation months and years later, some difference and some growth and an understanding, and understanding of God's act with them. And that's where we get, we are, we act, and we reflect. And deeper meanings come out of the events that happened in the past. Do any of you have reflections on this, observations about this? Does this ring true to you? You see what I'm trying to get at with this passage here?
What I hear you saying is that we pray for God's guidance in our lives, but we don't recognize it when it's happening always. And that we reflect on something that's happening and see His hand in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is good to come together and to share stories and testimonies about that. That's what these people are doing, I think.
Exactly. In other words, if we're a faith-filled people, we believe God is with us and, you know, caring for us, how do we come about that appreciation? How did the Israelites come about it in their search for freedom? And what did it mean to them?
I was remembering just before this particular passage that you read, they were all complaining about, why did you bring us out here? You know, we had full pots of meat before we left, and there was, things weren't so bad, and now you brought us out here to die. And even though they've just crossed over and may be happy about it, they may well still be at a point of saying, now what do we do? You know, we've left everything behind. There's sort of as much grief for the loss of everything that they've had, and where their forefathers, you know, at least their parents and grandparents may have been buried in their previous, in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a time of grieving as much as celebration, of acknowledging the death of their previous, however precarious, life. And so if there's comparison to us, it's pretty hard sometimes to worship God or to give thanks to Him when we're in the midst of grieving something that we're losing preparatory to whatever He's bringing about.
Yeah, you go through different stages of experience. It's a big part of that is grief, you know. And in the desert, you know, where they headed out for 40 years, were they? After this, there was a lot of that. It was a constant struggle between Moses and the people to be faithful.
I think about this as a cyclical one too, that if they had not recognized who they were, or if they had not acted, but any break in that cycle is what we do all the time. It's the importance of knowing who we are, whose we are, acting on that and reflecting on that. And you know, so often typically we don't do that. We either don't act, or we don't reflect, or we don't remember who we are. And that's a breakdown in our lives functioning.
And that, you're comparing that to the Israelites, but to our own ministry, to our own living.
Right. But also for the Israelites, if they hadn't acted, if they not recognized who they were, and acted, following God through the sea, which they did think about not doing, then the reflection would have been a totally different one. There's a cycle there that's important for us to remember, just as the Israelites followed that. If they had not followed any part of that cycle, it would be a totally different story.
Totally different story and a totally different appreciation of what happened. Yeah. I haven't thought of that angle. If they hadn't acted to be free, they would have continued being slaves. And what would that have said about?
But the core action there that they take is the prayer, and the rest of it is Yahweh. Mm-hmm. It's what you read at the beginning in chapter 2, which initiates the process for the Israelites. The action was to say, where are you, God, in the midst of our suffering, in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our grieving about where we are? And literally it moves from there, constantly Yahweh doing something else, doing something more. And that's real clear in the Jewish Seder. When they remember this story, when they remember the liberation, they always say, it would have been enough if you had just have done this. It would have been enough if you had just done this, Yahweh. And each time they remember that Yahweh is the force in that. And so when you talk about who we are, they remembered who they were, and their action was prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh took it from there.
That's through the eyes of faith. Growing faith, growing appreciation of God acting. It seems to me that you know, what was this? How many years before Christ? 2,000 years before Christ? Something like that? That the people were growing in their understanding of God and God's act. And they're probably at somewhat of a rudimentary state of things when this actually happened. I'm not denying your point. I'm just thinking that trying to project back a little bit we can to what they were seeing and feeling at the time, and then the continued reflection of that experience over the years and centuries that the people had. It must have evolved, you know, with each experience, with each action, with each reflection. Kelly, did you?
No. I just wanted to refocus this identity or identification also, because I can see in our contemporary lives, we could say we're Christians or we're Lutherans or we're Americans or we're humans or we're men or we're women. But these folks really were required to make a rather radical identification that says we are people of God, Israelites, even though we've been living here for 400 years, even though our homes and our families and all of our culture has probably been assimilated to a fair degree, because they didn't have all of the ritual and all of the ceremonies to the same degree that they have subsequently developed to help them remember who they were. In essence, the Exodus was the transformative event that consolidated the people of Israel. Before that, they didn't have a consolidating factor. And yet they had to identify
very strongly, who am I and how does this set me apart so that I have to act in this unique and different way at the risk of my life and my family's life? And that's a pretty radical thing to do if we try to apply it to ourselves. And yet maybe necessary.
Can you describe what you're saying in terms of, you know, I think you're saying is that people are kind of dispersed in Egypt.
I see that the Christians in America are dispersed, we don't have very much of a common identity, and we don't have a sense of set-apartness very often, and we therefore are not that willing to consider risking an Exodus-type experience and leaving behind our contemporary culture.
Wow, you really made a jump. That's I'm still trying to understand what you're saying about the people, but the people in Israel at the time, as I understand them, you know, even the idea of 12 tribes, but they were probably a hodgepodge, is my understanding, and this event brought that hodgepodge into some kind of unity. That experience formed them, and you just jumped 40 centuries or something like that.
Take it a step farther, though, because I think it's very difficult for us as Americans, especially. We live in so much plenty. I mean, we have so much to even comprehend. These people were living as slaves, and it was tough for them to give it all up and trust God. And he was talking about identity. And I think if somebody says, who are you? We say, where do we live? What do we do? How many kids do we have? Whereas the very first thing, the very first and key thing in our relationship, the only guarantee in our relationship through life is our relationship with God. Nothing else that we have, own, relate to is guaranteed to always be there except God. And that's a real hard thing to come to. Real hard thing to totally comprehend. And is it really first? Are we at a place where our relationship with God is so strong that if all else was gone and we were called to take up and follow Him, we could do it? Which is in a way what they were, to trust God that much.
They were down to just crying out, though.
Sure.
They were down to bare bones.
It was a lot easier for them.
They were being ground under. If I could get into the words that the Bible uses for enslavement, it's a grinding, afflictive type experience. And all you can do is yell, ouch, and help, Is that what you're saying?
Kind of, except that relating it today, I think, especially being a product of the me generation and self, we were talking about the other day, there's Self magazine, Us magazine. I mean, this is a generation that's just into, hey, I deserve everything in life. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely nothing in this book that tells us that. Absolutely zilch. And I think, we were actually, if you get down to it, we were put on earth to serve the Lord and to honor Him. And that may not be all the things we think we deserve. Mm-hmm. In life. Mm-hmm. And I think for those who are in slavery, I think I had spoken to somebody who'd been behind the Iron Curtain, and this was a real interesting concept, because he said the people there, as he was seeing these people meeting in dirty basements secretly with nothing, I mean, they didn't have a hymn book, they just met. And in his mind, he was thinking how difficult it was to be a Christian behind the Iron Curtain. And one of the people came up to him and said, it must be so difficult to be a Christian in America. And he said, what do you mean? And he said, the distractions. All we have is God. You guys have so many distractions that keep your focus on God. And I've really thought of that a lot. And I think about who we are. I mean, if you're going to start with who are we, I think every one of us has to stop and think. Are we, I think it's easier to follow God if you've been a slave and He says, I'll take you someplace better. Mm-hmm. But where we're at today, how easy is it to say, take my life?
Well, I'm trying not to go too far ahead today, but I really appreciate that comparison, because we're going to get more and more into that as the week goes along. if I could twist a little bit of what you're saying, that the Exodus experience, the enslavement in Egypt and the being freed from that, is the core experience of the Jewish people's existence to that point, because later Israelites became prosperous, and they became oppressive, and the prophets had a continual struggle to call them back to that original. So maybe what you're saying is, one reflection on this is that experience is a relationship with God. Maybe we can shift a little bit over here.
Well, that's what I think, gentlemen, that was referring to when he said that the one thing that they had was prayer, because prayer is by itself an acknowledgement of the relationship with God. You said they have very little to define in terms of rituals and the trappings and all of these kinds of things. And I would agree with that. That wasn't there. The one thing that was there throughout their history was their relationship with God. Even if it was dimly held in recesses of their mind, that was what defined them as a separate people in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were other slaves in Egypt. We know that historically. And they did not have the Exodus experience. So there was something there that created the potential of the Exodus experience. So it seemed to me that that was somewhere in that group was held an awareness that there was that relationship. So you call it prayer or whatever you call it in that terminology.
Prayer or a series of spiritual experiences.
A beingness,
mm-hmm.
Relationship with the essence.
Mm-hmm.
That is part of one's being.
I would agree that the prayer and the identification, and I think that is a part of the we are part of it, but they could have said, no, we're not leaving, this is too dangerous. And I think sometimes we don't put enough emphasis on the action. I think the prayer and the connection needs to be at the foundation, but I think sometimes we negate the power that God has given us to act. And at its lowest ebb, that's just sitting and praying and waiting for God to do something. You know, and these people had to get out of their houses and go. God didn't come along and pick them up.
I skipped a lot of that in the original presentation. I focused on the crying out of the prayer. That's what you meant by the prayer, I think. But I just mentioned the fact that the next chapter is Moses being called. He's out there in the bushes, because he fled, and he's raising somebody else's sheep in a foreign area, and God called Moses. That's the way it's presented. And Moses, I don't know how to talk in front of people. Well, I'll give you your brother Aaron, and he can talk for you, but you're called to lead. And so he kept coming up with excuses, and God kept empowering him through different methods to be that leader. So I think you're right. From their experience, there was a choice that a number of individuals as well as the whole people had. And, the desert experience after the crossing of the Red Sea was one constant struggle. Should we go back to our slavery? At least we ate there. And, or to go on. So.
Just another thought about identity. The folks, in order to leave, also had to realize not only who they were, but they had to realize their predicament. They had to realize that they were in bondage, that this was not their natural state of affairs, that this was not just the way things were and had to be. And as saying, we're not slaves, but we're in bondage, it empowered them to see themselves as more before God and as a community.
And to come to a collective realization of that. Yeah, the first two chapters in that book of Exodus shows a gradual progression. It must have taken a lot of years, where the slavery became harder and harder, and the people probably gradually came to a realization that they were indeed a slave. They were no longer Joseph's brothers and sisters given special treatment in this country. And that realization had to come to maturity before they were able to cry out. Kelly?
This may be picky, but I'd like to go back to the point about prayer. To me, prayer is all three. Prayer is we are, we act, we reflect. So I think that that's a given. And so I kind of like picking apart the other three, given that prayer is identity, action, and reflection.
Can I ask what makes, being I can understand somewhat, but acting as a prayer to you, why do you believe acting is a prayer? I just want to draw all that out. I think it's a critical point. I believe it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a communication. It's a form of communication with God.
Mm-hmm. So it's based on your relationship with God. And I think this is a key point in the Old Testament, is being in relationship with God. Prayer is relational. Justice is relational. And by the very fact you have that relationship, you know, is this what you're saying? That's what I say. It is in prayer.
I can't say any more clearly than it is
there.
Yeah, you know, it's all three of those.
Yeah.
But you can get to pray as an action. It is an action. It's a verb. If you're living your life, you
just do.
Praying without ceasing throughout your day, mm-hmm. as you're acting out what God wants you to be, you're in communication with Him.
Mm-hmm.
And then prayer is an action. It's a way of life.
But part of that, when you say it's all three, when you look at prayer and we say we act, but our action is a response to God. It's a response to the gospel. It's a response to love. It's a response to what we know was right to begin with. And so when we say that all three of those are prayer, and when we act, we are in a response to what we have been challenged to do, that we have that guideline put before us, we have that the freedom before us, that image of freedom, and it's a response to God's word. And so when you look at Moses or Miriam or Aaron, each one of them are responding to something that God has asked them to do. And so that when we act, it needs to be set within that context of a response to God. Not our own action, but a response to what God has already called us to do and be. And who we are. You know, Kelly says, whose we are. You know, because that gives us the identity, it gives us the action. And then the reflection comes in. The prayer then becomes the prayer, the dance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. It then becomes that response, and again it's that response to God and what God has done for us and what we were part of that doing.
So you're just basically agreeing with Kelly.
Right.
And I didn't hear that, but I think that's what's good about the discussion, is to define our terms, define what we're seeing here. I think. A lot of my upbringing was prayers when I'm making a petition, God help me with this, or sitting there just thinking. But prayer is a state of being in the way we're talking about it.
But when we're going back to the Israelites, is that the evidence that they as a group did that? I mean, it seems like they were a bunch of naysayers almost, and then were dragged along by the few that... And having few choices, they waited till they didn't have many choices left before they got out of there. The evidence was pretty strong. We saw the plagues or whatever. So, I mean, we're kind of talking here about a group now that we want to be a unified group, and it doesn't seem, when we're going back to that point, that the evidence is that was true.
Yeah, my sense is it was a ragtag group at times, and at times it was a beautiful unified group, you know, that the dance at the Red Sea had to be everybody's exhilaration, you know, because it was a, you know, a clear victory. But later on, when people start grumbling and tailing off, it's like our congregations when things aren't going
like
well.
Today, yeah.
We don't look too unified, we don't look too faith-filled, and so forth. So we create images.
Well, in the Exodus period, with Moses, leading them forth, and then the stronghold of the relationship was between Moses and his relationship with God, and that sense of relationship had not, seems to me, spread throughout. It was not present within the community, but it was. I think a lot of people moved forth given the history, and trust and faith moved in their action, followed, and then they began to question and wonder and argue and wonder what was their situation. And they asked, later, well, why is it that you're only speaking through Moses? And, what is this real calls and question constantly, first the identification of who they were and then their action, and then reflecting on that and asking more questions. And again, the cycle, I like your image, Kelly, and that it continues to move then, that after they've done the action and they're reflecting on it, asking more questions, moving them further to define whose they are, and a development of their faith, ultimately to writing and recording through their perspective of their actions historically, where they were walking with God.
That sounds like deep, getting deeper into who we are, into what life is about, and how we deal with life. That it takes time. And that's, I think, the basic point of reading that chapter 15, is that that's not an expression of a mature understanding that happened at that moment of crossing the Red Sea, but the core was there, the basic experience was there, but the deepening reflection was later on.
I think they had a sense of unity more than we're giving them credit for, because as I read back in the chapter 1, it talks about the Pharaoh said that to the midwives that they must kill all the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
The midwives refused to do that, and that because they feared God. And it seems to me, if all the midwives refused to do it, there must have been quite a bit of communication and understanding. I think that they had an identity that allowed them to finally follow Moses out of there. They knew that he was a man of God, and they were people of God.
I don't think I was saying that there wasn't that. There had to be a shared understanding at some level of God in relationship to God. That seems to be what unified them. But how well defined was that, and how it was spelled out in their thinking, we don't know too much about that. But there had to be a group of people that shared an experience of God and faith that Moses could call, say, I got this call in the desert to work with you to come out. You think of community organizing today, my experience, you go into a community and you try to pick an issue that the people share by talking to the people and find out what common issue people have, and you organize around that. Well, Moses did the same thing. We come from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and we know God called them and so forth. So there had to be that common experience that Moses could organize around. So I agree with you. It's just how well it was defined. And what I think we're saying here, we grew an appreciation of it as the time went along. Yeah.
seems to me one part that's missing, and maybe it's all in the we act, is that things happen in our lives that change how we see God acting in our lives, and whether we make a decision on whether he's responsible for what happens in our lives or whether he comes to be the Emmanuel or to be with us in what's happening. I see that a lot of the fundamentalistic denominations proposing a God that's in control of everything, and anything that happens in my life is because of him, or at least anything good. The Oregon Lottery at $23 million was doing a lot of people say, well, God intervened on our behalf to help us win this, and that's why we're going to do all this good stuff with it. You know, and I guess I see a real tension between saying that God is acting in our lives and that somehow he's responsible for everything that happens.
I can't do that myself. And I think that's what
it's a tension for me, because I've come much more to a God who promises to come and be with me in what's happening,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily in control of everything that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's also given me a mind and a free will to make choices, and some of those choices will result in pain and suffering in my life.
Yeah.
And if you come back to Israel, they had a choice of whether to go with Moses or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They may later come back and blame him for leading them into the desert, but they also chose to go.
That's right. They went forward and they chose to identify with God as their leader and savior.
They give God the credit for drowning the Egyptians. You know, they don't see that as just a natural happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
But they also then can turn around and blame God if they're hungry or they haven't got a diversity of food. And, at what point, do we take our own personal responsibility and say, God gave us a mind and gave us choices? One of the gifts of Eden was the free choice.
Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to grasp here, I think, is what was the Old Testament view, because we're part of that legacy. This is part of our tradition. And what was the view? And I think we're learning that there were several stages in that, but one of the key experiences was, if not the key experience, was the Exodus experience. Liberation, did you want to?
Reflecting on that, before funerals, we have a half an hour of a time of remembering who we are in relation to the person who died. In other words, we remember who we are in the midst of our community. And at the end of that, we say, now we're going to worship to remember who we are in relation to our Christian community, or that God is with us no matter where we're at. It's difficult for me sometimes to say just who I am, to be honestly, to say this is who I am, rather than saying this is who I wish I were. And so we need to allow those times, it seems to me, to say this is who I am, and then to discover that God is with us. And that may be the power, I don't know, of the Old Testament message. So rather than, we starting where we're at,
mm-hmm.
and saying God is with us.
Yeah. Well, what we're trying to say here is that our stories are important.
Yeah.
Individual stories and community stories, congregational, communities we live in. A lot of different stories there. And it depends on how we understand life as to how we interpret those stories. And the legacy of the Old Testament is the Exodus experience. And because of time, we're not going to get later into the Old Testament to show even more how that was played out, when the Israel people were no longer slaves but free and having their own country. Liberation became God speaking on behalf of and working on behalf of the poor, the orphan, the widow, and the alien is the classic people of that. And so liberation was not just the liberation of a total people, but of people suffering. And that's a big part of the legacy of the Old Testament that Christ takes up, you know, when he comes and carries on from there to a whole new understanding. I'd like to encourage people that haven't spoke to speak to them.
I was just reflecting on her thought about this sort of journey to personal responsibility. Looking at the Old Testament, these folks didn't have much concept of personal responsibility. In my understanding, they were animistic. They were just one step away from believing that gods inhabited the rocks and the thunderstorms and the mountains, and they were set apart to now believing that God was one in the heavens, but pervasive in their lives, and they thought everything was caused by God or gods in the fertility rituals and all of the different activities of farming and agriculture and the cycles of life were thought to be external forces. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about, will we touch on this journey towards how to internalize, how to develop this personal responsibility from God and external world as responsible for everything that happens to me? Because that's a real key issue with this fundamentalist interpretation about who God is and who am I in relationship and how much is my responsibility or how much does he intervene? Old Testament, has he intervened mightily and constantly?
I thought there was one God. And I think a big part of the struggle was the Egyptians had a lot of household gods, you know, and they became the false idols. And you know, there was a struggle between the prophets to get the people to let go of those and believe in the one spiritual God.
Just to reinforce this point, this does precede the Ten Commandments. I think that's very true.
Yeah, no, that makes the point even more. I feel like that we should go on for 2 hours because I'm about half of the material I wanted to deal with today, to bring us today, but I think we also covered the main point. If we were to go further, we could come to the appreciation that God established a relationship with us, and that's the basis of justice. Justice is our relationship to God and to one another. And alienation takes place when we choose to ignore our relationship to God or to go counter to the relationship to God. That's when the state of sin comes in, is to leave God. And the prophetic thing was, you have chosen Israel to ignore your God, and idolatry and oppression and all these dysfunctional things follow from it, even to the point of being alienated from nature. Nature itself rebels because you have chosen not to be faithful to your relationship with me and to one another. And liberation, therefore, in the Old Testament is not just from the physical oppression that you establish in slavery, but it's from a false attachment to idols, the kinds of things you're talking about.
What will be tomorrow, Bernie?
What I want to do tomorrow is get into the New Testament and in a further development of liberation, you know, not just spiritual, but to integrate the social justice type things and what it means to be free people, both from a physical and a spiritual standpoint. What I'm a little bit frustrated about today is I had some readings of people in El Salvador that, you know, reflect back to Miriam's dance. And for me, one thing that's very important is this is Parting of the Waters, and it's a bit of about the civil rights movement called the King Years from 54 to 63. it's meaningful to me because while I wasn't a part of the heart of this, I was, as a young clergyman, involved in social issues in the 60s. And I had some interaction with pieces of it, and this fills in a big part of the picture for me. And my reflection is, you know, this is part of my story, I'm part of it, and it's deepened my belief and my understanding of life and what we're into today. In parting the waters, it just fits, you know, the Exodus experience and this being Rainbow on a Mountain Week and all that. This is a fantastic book in my mind. It's well written. Taylor Branch got a Pulitzer Prize for it. And it's exciting reading, and if it were a novel, it would be exciting. But it's real life, and I was going to read some parts to show how people in King's time, especially King, he wasn't always the leader. You know, we see him as out there in front, but there are parts in here that shows he was grasping, you know, like Moses must have grasped what to do next, you know, how to be effective and how to. You know, he believed in a lot of the principles that Gandhi had of nonviolence and civil disobedience, and he was going to all these conferences and trying to study. You know, what's the answer? What's the way? And then the students come out and pop out of the woodwork and take you a sit-in, and you know, people ignored students for a lot of times. You know, they were just little one-shot deals and didn't have that much impact. Suddenly in Greenboro, the students did a sit-in and proceed through that experience, a chink in the armor of the white controlling power structure, and King was running to catch up and make a breakthrough, said, oh, we got to do this more, and, you know, it's a much better related in here than I'm doing. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that Moses, at times was ahead and at times was behind, and King was at times ahead and at times behind, and that's the way it works. And for me, it helps me understand social change a lot, but also how to deal with understanding life. You know, that you don't always have the answers, and sometimes you're running to catch up, and a good way to do that is by reflecting on experiences in community.
Thank you.
Thank you.